They were calm. We picked up speed. There was a whine above the other sounds. Were we hit? The chopper stopped again. The crew opened the door. The machine gunner started firing even before he looked out. The killers had arrived. We jumped from the chopper. It was faster now. One foot on the ski, then down. Move, move. The other squads in our company had landed at the same time. We moved toward the village. We could see fires up ahead.
Spread left! Spread left! Keep your distances!
Sergeant Simpson barked orders. We moved straight ahead until we came within 40 meters of the village. Several of the huts were on fire. There were people milling about. Even from where we were, we could hear the wailing.
Let's move!
Gerhardt went first. We followed. The VC had already struck. There were bodies all around, some twisted awkwardly, others looking as if they were just resting, their legs bent for comfort. We started checking out the huts, empty except for the villagers. Some were hurt bad.
Two platoon, on perimeter!
I turned and saw Captain Stewart. He must have been in one of the other choppers. The village looked like the one they had constructed for practice at Fort Devens, only here there were real people. An old woman stumbled into the open space in front of her hut. Her face was covered with blood. She fell. I went over to her, looked at her, and saw the bones in her face where the flesh had been cut away. Turn away. There was a sense of panic in the air. We had our weapons ready. Sergeant Simpson was telling us not to kill the civilians. I didn't consciously want to kill anybody, anything, but I felt strange. The sight of all the bodies lying around, the smell of blood and puke and urine made my head spin, pushed me to a different place. I wanted to fire my weapon to destroy the nightmare around me. I didn't want it to be real, this much death, this much dying, this waste of human life. I didn't want it. I looked around until I found Monaco. There were tears in his eyes, but his mouth was twisted in hate and anguish and confusion. I turned away from Monaco's pain. It wasn't the time for comforting each other. The heat from the burning huts was intense, the shimmering air creating phantom figures all around us. There was a burst of fire behind me. I turned. Wallowick was firing toward a steel drum that lay on its side. I reached for a grenade just as Simpson ran past me. He grabbed Wallowick and threw both arms around him.
Easy, man, easy.
I stood with the grenade in my hand on the pin, ready to pull it out and arm it. I watched Simpson holding Wallowick. Around us, the other guys went on with their searching. I looked back at Wallowick. He had freaked out. He was breathing hard, and Sergeant Simpson was still holding him. Wallowick was a rock. A fucking rock. And he had freaked out. I turned away. I was going to be cool. I had to be. We went from hut to hut. They were all empty. Some guys formed a bucket brigade and started trying to put the fire out of the huts that were still burning. The company was calming down. We bandaged some of the wounds. Captain Stewart called in some medevacs to take out the wounded Vietnamese. We began coming down, but it wasn't easy. Stepping around the bodies, turning away from the stench, from the reality of the death around us. I stopped for a moment to look at the bodies of two old men, their arms around each other in death. I saw them even after I turned away. We could have killed as easily as we mourned. We could have burned as easily as we put out the fires. We were scared, on the very edge of control, at once trying to think of what was right to do and hating the scene about us. I think if Simpson hadn't been there, it would have been worse, much worse. He calmed us down, brought us back to ourselves. He let us be human again. And all the inhumanity about us, he let us be human again.
They messed up at least one person from each hut, Pee-wee said. They cut a baby's head off.
Monaco spoke slowly. His face was dark. His mouth quivered between words.
How the hell do you kill a friggin' baby?
Like the majors say, Pee-wee said. They showing the people we can't protect them, so they might as well be on Charlie's side.
You know what this is like? Like a trip to friggin' hell,
Monaco said.
Nah, man. This is like the projects in Chicago, Pee-wee said. The police can't protect your ass from the muggers and shit, and the muggers don't protect your ass from the police.
This ain't like Chicago, Monaco said. They don't kill babies in no Chicago. Stewart told us to go to each hut and pick out the wounded, who looked most like they were going to live, and get them ready for evacuation.
If you see anybody who looks like a VC, make a note of it, he said.
Body counts. I looked over at Simpson, but he was looking away. I thought I remembered where Aunt Lynn lived, and I went to look for her. I found her and an old woman who looked like she could have been her great-grandmother. They looked okay. When Aunt Lynn saw me, she started crying and tried to get behind the old woman. Okay. I could dig where she was coming from. I looked around for Aunt Lynn's mother. I didn't see her. I tried once or twice to ask the old woman, but I couldn't get through to her. She was squatting against the wall, one thin brown arm raised, the hand over her forehead. She looked as if she might have been still in shock. I was glad to see that Aunt Lynn was all right. It was what it was getting to be. Hoping that what you liked, what you had seen before, remained whole. I didn't have anything to give to Aunt Lynn, so I gave her a dollar. I knew there wasn't much she could do with it in the boonies, but I gave it to her anyway. As I left, she followed me with her eyes, and I wondered what she saw. The next hut looked empty. There were two bowls on the table. One still had some kind of food. It looked like a thick soup in it. The VC must have caught them by surprise, in the middle of a meal. Maybe saying grace. There were pictures on a small wicker chest. I went to see them. A thin Vietnamese man in shirt sleeves stood squinting at the camera. On one side of him was a woman and on the other side a bicycle. He had both of his hands on the bicycle. A click. Another. I turned to look at the muzzle of a gun. Click, click. I couldn't move. It was like a dream. I was watching it, but I couldn't move. It was a dream of my death. A gun was pointed at my chest. A small brown man was pumping the bolt frantically to get it to work. Click, click, click. He came at me and swung the butt of the rifle toward my head. I blocked it with my arm and backed away. He swung again and hit my shoulder, the rifle glancing up from my shoulder into the side of my face. I pulled the trigger of my rifle without lifting it. He went down on one knee. Then it was as if I were suddenly awake. I lifted the M16 and started firing it in his face. I emptied the clip. I snatched another one from my belt, slammed it in, and fired that point blank.
Don't move, I screamed at him. Don't move. Perry, back away.
Sergeant Simpson's voice snapped at me from the doorway.
Back away, man.
I backed away, keeping my rifle pointed at the VC. Sergeant Simpson went over to him. Then he lowered his rifle.
He ain't in this war no more, he said.
By that time, a couple of other guys had shown up. I thought my hands were bleeding, but I went to check out the VC before I put my piece down. There was no face, just an angry mass of red flesh where the face had been. Part of an eyeball dangled from one side of the head. At the top, there were masses of different colored flesh. The white parts were the worst. There was a tooth, a bit of skull. I turned away. I vomited. My hands weren't bleeding. It was that much sweat pouring down my arms and forearms and from my palms. I heard Sergeant Simpson tell Pee-wee to stay with me. Pee-wee put his arm around my waist and told me to come on. We left the hut and went to the next one.
They got some tea on the stove in there, Pee-wee said.
I went in with Pee-wee, then pulled myself together. I didn't want the tea. Maybe I was afraid of it. Pee-wee said that we should go outside and sit down. I said okay. We had just left the hut when Pee-wee stopped and turned around.
Wait a minute, he said.
His voice was lower than usual, almost a rumble from his throat. He started back toward the hut. I went after him. We walked into the hut, and he went over toward the corner. There was a rattan throw mat on the floor. One quarter of it was around a bamboo pole that was about 6 feet high. Pee-wee aimed at the mat and fired twice.
I just thought that could have been a breathing tube or something, Pee-wee said.
I tried to move the mat with my foot. It didn't move. I looked around until I saw a piece of string. I tied it to the mat and went across the room.
I'll jerk the string, I said. You cover it.
I jerked it and the mat came up. Even from where we stood, we could see the body. He wasn't dead. Captain Stewart came in and asked what was going on. Pee-wee pointed toward the wounded Kong. Captain Stewart finished him off. The company surrounded the hamlet. Captain Stewart called in evacuation helicopters. We loaded up the villagers who were still there. We didn't know how many more Kongs were hiding in the huts, half buried under furniture or mats, but he wasn't going to risk any of us to find out. We moved the rest of the people out to the landing zone and burned the whole place down. Two VC came out from one hut that we were burning. They had their hands up. A woman from the village went over and stabbed one in the side. He tried to get her knife away from her, and two guys lit him up. His body jerked around like a rag puppet being dragged by a dog. I had killed a man. I thought about how he looked, how I had felt. I remembered looking down at him, the M16 in my hands, my forearms aching from the tension of holding it. I remembered looking down at him and feeling my own face torn apart. I thought of the other one, too. It was a nightmare. A nightmare of me crouching somewhere listening to the enemy above. Maybe they wouldn't see me. Just take a shot to see if I was there. The wounded were taken out first. Our squad was on perimeter patrol while others lifted the litters onto the choppers. The throaty sound of the mortars could still be heard, and the incoming fire was getting closer. They were calling in artillery to shut down the incoming mortars, even though it was estimated that the mortars were almost on top of us. The first choppers lifted off and the others started coming in. I couldn't believe they would come in with all the heat in the area. But they came. Great insects, angry and buzzing over the steaming jungle, ignoring the fact that every hostile in the area was trying to bring them down. Any direct hit would bring death to the entire crew, and they all had to know it. And they still came. I looked over my shoulder at the choppers as they landed, blowing away the loose grass and debris on the ground. A glassine bandage wrapping danced across the area between the huts, flattened itself momentarily against the small, still body of a dead NVA soldier, and then flew off into the jungle. The chopper crews. They were the stuff of heroes, swooping from the skies like great heavenly birds, gathering the angels who had fallen below. When we got back to the compound, Pee-wee couldn't walk. He jumped from the chopper, and his legs gave way under him. Johnson had to carry him to the hooch. They got him back to our hut, and Gearhart got a medic over.
Get the fuck away from me, Pee-wee told the medic.
Let him look at your legs, soldier. Captain Stewart was in our hooch.
Ain't nothing wrong with my damn legs, Pee-wee said. All I need is a cigarette.
Captain Stewart gave him a cigarette, and he lit up. The medic told Pee-wee again to relax while he took his pants off. Pee-wee took his own pants off. He was right. There wasn't anything wrong with his legs. I laughed and Pee-wee laughed and we were all laughing. Then Pee-wee started coughing from the cigarette and the medic gave him some water. Stewart left after saying something about how good we had done. Gearhart came over and talked with us for a while. Just small talk. He was shaken from what we had been through. Nobody got used to it. Good. Brew's hand began to jerk and that scared him. We were all jumpy. It wasn't that we were hurt. It was just that we couldn't get down. We had been shooting and screaming and scared that somebody, that something was going to kill us. We just couldn't get down that easily. It didn't stop when they blew the whistle. I didn't know if it would ever stop. After a while, Johnson noticed that we were all whispering. He laughed a quiet little laugh, and we all laughed about that.
"How the hell do you smoke a cigarette with half of it in your mouth?" Gearhart asked Pee-wee.
"You know what this is?" Pee-wee asked. "This is the first cigarette I've ever smoked."
Later, we went to the recreation hooch and watched the news. It was all about President Johnson trying to get a bill passed to help the urban poor, and then something about the Pueblo, which had been taken over by the North Koreans. Then there was a big thing on the Super Bowl and whether or not the Packers had a dynasty going. It wasn't real that people were thinking about things like that when all this shit was going on. It just wasn't real. Sleeping didn't come hard. It didn't come at all. I was asleep, in a way, and yet I wasn't.
Pee-wee?
What?
How you doing?
Okay.
How you doing?
Okay, I said. You know what happened today in the hut?
What?
That VC popped up from no damn where, I said. First thing I heard was him trying to blow me away. His weapon didn't work. If it had, he would have got me, Pee-wee. He would have got me. I started crying. And Pee-wee got up and came to my bunk. He put his arms around me and held me until we both fell asleep.
We got word that we were moving again, someplace near Tam Kai. The whole outfit was going, but Alpha was going first. Captain Stewart told us we were supposed to act as advisors to the ARVN troops. Nobody trusted him. Lobo got a map and we figured out exactly where Tam Kai was and figured we didn't want to be there. The Marines were at Chulai, which was pretty safe. They were also up north fighting their rear ends off. Tam Kai was being hit a lot, and Lobo figured that if the VC wanted to hit someplace near there, the ARVN base would be easier than the Marines.
"You got too big a base for them to hit at Chulai," he said. "They're already fighting like crazy up north, so they hit the ARVNs at Tam Kai. It figures." "Hey, Lobel."
Sergeant Simpson was packing up his gear and his personal supply of ammunition. He had all of these clips that he had checked round by round, and he was taking it all with him.
"You don't agree?" Lobel asked. "Why don't you go back to your damn movies? Because I only got 8 days left, and that's too damn short to be listening to your war theories."
Jamal came over to tell us that he was going to be with our squad from now on. He looked scared.
"You think you're man enough to go out with us?"
Brunner said.
"No, I don't think so," Jamal said, "but they're sending me anyway."
Mail call. Brunner got a letter from his wife in Seattle. She was a waitress in a coffee shop down near the waterfront, and the coffee urn blew up. It burned her arm and right leg, but it wasn't serious, she said. Brunner went out of his mind over it. He couldn't understand how a damn coffee urn could blow up. I got a letter from Mama. She told me that Pee-wee wrote her and he seemed like the nicest boy. She wrote that she was glad that he and I were friends. I hoped she would get to meet him one day. I thought they would have got along just fine. The thing was, I needed the people in the world to be okay, and to be the same as when I left them. I was holding on now, and I needed something to hold on to. I had come into the army at 17, and I remembered who I was, and who I was had been a kid. The war hadn't meant anything to me then, maybe because I had never gone through anything like it before. All I had thought about combat was that I would never die, that our side would win, and that we would all go home somehow satisfied. And now all the dying around me and all the killing was making me look at myself again, hoping to find something more than the kid I was. Maybe I could sift through the kid stuff, the basketball, the Harlem streets, and find the man I would be. I hoped I did it before I got killed. The rain came down in buckets. We watched a newscast that said that a guy had got a heart transplant. They had actually taken the heart out of one guy who had been in an accident and put it in another guy, a dentist. Brunner and Wallowick thought it was cool, but Pee-wee didn't believe it. And Monica wondered how the guy lived between the time they took his heart out and the time they put the other guys in.
"The whole thing is going to be in life next week," Bruce said. "You wait and see."
I dreamt about being in the hut and hearing the VC trying to get his rifle to work. In the dream, he smiled as he worked it, and I stood there crying, knowing that eventually it would work and that he would kill me. He would blow my face away the way I had blown his away in real life. I kept waking up in a kind of terror, and then falling to sleep again and having the same dream. In the morning, we were roused early for the trip. Pee-wee was messed up. Really messed up.
"What the hell happened to you?" I asked.
He looked like he had been in a fight and been beaten up bad. His whole face was puffed up badly. His upper lip was so swollen he could hardly get his mouth shut.
"Nothing," he said.
Gearhart had heard about how Pee-wee looked, and he came over and asked what had happened. Pee-wee said nothing had happened and turned away.
"Gates, can you make it to the new base?" Gearhart asked.
"Yeah,"
Pee-wee said. He could hardly talk. He kept packing his gear.
"Look, man, we gotta know what happened,"
Sergeant Simpson said.
"We a squad, we ain't no strangers."
"You know that stuff I got from that woman?"
Pee-wee said.
"What?
That her stuff?"
"Yeah.
I put some on my lip to grow me a mustache,"
he said. He put his head down.
"Guess it don't work too cool."
Chapter 15. I started writing a letter to Kenny. At first, I thought I wanted to tell him about the war, about how I felt about the fighting. Then I knew I wanted to tell him about my killing the Kong. I started the letter off really cool, hoping that he was okay and taking care of Mama, stuff like that. Then I told him I wanted to tell him about a typical day that I had here in the Nam. Then I changed it to special day instead of typical. Then I tried to tell him about the killing. I started off saying that war was about destroying the enemy. Then I remembered about the news guys asking us why we were fighting in Vietnam. It wasn't the same. Saying that you were trying to stop communism or stuff like that was different than shooting somebody. It was different than being scared and looking at somebody who was maybe as scared as you were. In a way, I wanted him to know about me killing the Kong. In another way, I didn't. I wanted him to think I was a good soldier. Being a good soldier meant doing your job. For the guys in the squad, it meant killing the enemy. Before I went into the army, I had thought about being a writer. Teachers said I used words well. But writing that I had done a good job killing just didn't work.
"Yo, Pee-wee,
What's shaking?
You know that Kong I killed?
Yeah.
How come I killed him?
Because he was going to kill your ass if you didn't kill his,
Pee-wee said. That's the only reason?
Ain't that good enough?
I don't know. Is it?
It better be till you get your ass home,
Pee-wee said.
Man, this ain't even Booneyville,
Sergeant Simpson said.
This is the suburbs of Booneyville.
He threw his gear on the small folding cot in the hooch that was our new home outside of Tam Kai.
You should have known this place was going to be garbage,
Brenner said.
We were right outside of Chulai and that wasn't that hot.
Brenner was right. The base at Chulai was almost like the old section of Fort Devens. The barracks were neat and clean, and there was even a post exchange. Where we had been bivouacked west of Chulai had been cool too. Our new area was something else again. It looked like the other fire bases with barbed wire and minefields around it. But I didn't see anything that looked like a major generator, which meant that it was going to be dark as hell at night. The hooches were half underground and didn't look as if they could take much in the way of direct hits. If we got incoming mortar, we would have to roll out of the hooches into the sandbag-lined trenches around them. I didn't like it at all.
The streams around here are a little murky, Lieutenant Gearhart said. Make sure you take your malaria pills.
I'm taking every kind of pill I can get my hands on,
Pee-wee said.
I'll take some birth control pills if I could find me some.
There were a few guys there from a boat outfit, the 159th Transportation Battalion. We asked them what they were doing so far away from the water if they were supposed to be boat people. They said that they were teaching the ARVN troops, the Vietnamese friendlies, how to maintain the engines on their landing craft. They any good? I asked.
They don't seem to get the hang of how we do things, a sergeant said. They don't expect stuff to work, so when it doesn't, it's no big deal. They don't believe in maintenance at all.
What it looked like to me was that we were going to beat down the Kongs and then turn over the last part of the effort to the ARVN troops. That sounded just okay with me. We went on night patrol. Night patrol from our last base was scary. Night patrol from the new base was something else. We were picked up at 2000 hours. The LZ was in tall grass, which made us all feel uneasy. Somebody said that an ARVN captain had selected it. The only thing I really knew about ARVNs was what Sergeant Simpson said, and that wasn't good. He said that some units were good as anything we had to offer. Other units were crap and would bug out on you in a moment. What we were supposed to be doing was what they called an interdiction number, which meant that we were supposed to be cutting off the routes the Kongs could use to cut off First Corps from the rest of the war. The area just north of Chulai was what they seemed to want. The Kongs we were after had been probing along our defenses, looking for soft spots. They would set up a mortar attack from somewhere within the jungle, raise a little hell, and then split before anyone could get to them. HQ figured the Kong operation to be a squad-sized unit. We had two squads from Alpha Company and two ARVN squads to clear them out. What we were supposed to do was to set up an ambush on what we figured to be their route. We hit the LZ at 2035 hours. We went in first and cleared the LZ, and then the ARVNs came in. We had four squads, but only 25, maybe 26 guys. All of the squads were short except ours. Simpson said they kept our squad up to par because the battalion commander liked him. Near Chulai, the patrols had been serious, but away from Chulai, in the deep boonies, they were dead serious. There was no talking from the time we hit the LZ. Once we hit the wood line, the ARVNs broke off from us and went ahead. We were supposed to set up a company-sized L-trap. Sergeant Simpson didn't like it because it was too big, and we didn't know how the ARVNs would react. I just hoped and prayed we weren't walking into one. Wallowick was on point. Brunner was in the rear, and Johnson was left flank. I was in the middle again, right behind Brew. In the darkness, you couldn't keep the proper distance.
You were always afraid that you would lose the dude in front of you, that you would suddenly find yourself walking through the woods alone. We had signals, but they didn't help when it was really dark.
Don't think about anything, Sergeant Simpson had said. Don't think about your mama, don't think about your girlfriends, nothing. Just look around and be alert.
Sergeant Simpson had 6 days left in Nam. Brunner said that Captain Stewart had been on his case to extend for 3 months. The squad said that we would try to watch out for him, but we knew it didn't mean much. I looked around. I couldn't see anything. I listened for Bru's footsteps. He sounded like a cat moving through the night. I heard the cat. We reached the ambush site. The two ARVN squads formed the short end of the L. The two Alpha Company squads were the long side. Lieutenant Gearhart set out the claymores. He had the detonating wires, too. We waited. I was lying on my stomach. I tried not to think of anything that would get my mind off of what I was doing. I tried to control my imagination, to keep the shadows from becoming things they weren't. Something crawled across my wrist. I jumped and just managed not to cry out. It was too dark to see what it was, but it was still there. I tried to brush it off, but it didn't move. I felt it. I thought it was a finger. For a crazy-ass minute, I thought there was a Kong behind me, and he had just dropped a finger on me. I grabbed it and squeezed. It was soft and mushy. My heart was pounding. Every Kong in the world had to hear it. I wanted to turn over and look behind me. I wanted to cry. I remembered something. It was a picture of a guy with his hands on a bicycle. It was the picture that I had seen in the hut. I tried to picture the guy's face that I had shot. Was it the same guy? Could it have been his hut? I wondered what he would have said if he had killed me. Would he have said that he was trying to stop the spread of whatever the hell he thought I stood for? What did he think I stood for? What did the bullets feel like going into his face? Don't think. Stop thinking. Stop. Look ahead of me. Don't think. Don't daydream. Look. Quiet. Suppose everybody had left except me. I didn't hear anybody. Why was I so afraid of being left alone? It was possible. I knew it was possible. Look. I couldn't see anything. Once in a while, the moon would be bright enough to cast a shadow. Somebody had the starlight scope. Probably Sergeant Simpson. In the moonlight, I looked at my wrist. A fucking leech. I got my bayonet out and cut it in half, then scraped it off my wrist. It stung like crazy. Ignore it? Sure. We waited for an hour that seemed like 4 hours. We waited for another hour that seemed like 4 more hours. Voices. Charlie. They were supposed to be so quiet, so cool. I moved my hand up to the trigger. The first Charlies were in the killing zone. I waited. I wanted to pull the trigger. I knew they were passing the claymores. I heard them talking. My hands were sweating. We had the upper hand. We had them in the killing zone. I was waiting for Lieutenant Gearhart to open up with the claymores. The claymores would waste them. They were terrible. Nothing happened. The Charlies were going through the killing zone and out the other side. What the hell had happened? Where the hell was the squad? I heard the Charlies go off into the night. They must have passed the ARVNs, too. What the fuck happened? Pee-wee's voice in the darkness. Shut up! Gearhart. Pee-wee mumbled something to himself and was quiet. Okay, it was cool. We weren't going to do the ambush. We would wait until morning and then split. Maybe Gearhart was scared. He had made a mistake before and we had lost a man and had one wounded. Now he was playing it safe. I relaxed. My wrist stung. It felt like the leech was still on it. Voices. More Charlies. They were talking again, taking a stroll through the woods. They entered the killing zone.
I kept telling myself not to think about the wrist, and I kept thinking about it. The voices continued. How many of them were there? The nearly full moon drifted from behind some clouds, and I got my head down. I looked up. There were the Charlies. Only instead of the four or five I had imagined, there seemed to be an endless line. I opened my mouth so I could breathe quietly. I had to pee. Voices behind us. The woods were crawling with Charlies. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Don't think, don't even think of God, I thought. I thought of all the good things I had done in my life. I didn't deserve to die. I didn't want to die. The voices went on for another 10 minutes. If we had sprung the ambush, we wouldn't have stood a chance.
Let's get out of here.
Brunner.
Shut up.
Gearhart. Quiet. More voices. They kept coming. It lasted nearly 15 minutes. It was only 15 minutes, but it seemed like an eternity. Still, we didn't move. A half hour passed after we heard the last one move, before I heard Gearhart calling us together. Simpson went out and got the claymores, and we started going back, careful not to take the route the Charlies had taken in case they minded. Jamal was shaking so badly, I wondered how he could have stayed still all that time. How you doing, man? He didn't answer. I looked at him and he was crying. I made a note to tell Simpson. If Jamal was that shaky, he was going to get us all killed. There had been too many Charlies to pull an ambush. They would have wiped us out. I wasn't sure how many there had been, and I thought that Gearhart was only estimating.
There had to be at least a battalion.
Gearhart was on the radio as soon as we got back to the base. Pee-wee was trying to burn what was left of the leech off my wrist with a cigarette. The damn thing was disgusting.
What did they say?
Sergeant Simpson looked at Gearhart when he put down the phone.
They wanted to know if we saw any identifying patches on them,
Gearhart said.
How do you figure there were so many?
Wallowick asked.
They were talking too much, Gearhart said. Too confident.
If it had been me, I thought, I would have screwed it up. I would have. Sergeant Simpson extended for 30 days. Nobody wanted to look at him. Nobody wanted to see him. It was as if he had decided to die. That's what we all felt. They gave him another stripe. He was a master sergeant. Big deal. Most of the guys that extended in Nam did it for the rank, but some had other things in their heads. It was as if the idea that any moment they could be killed excited them. I knew a kid on 119th Street of 8th Avenue like that. He had run with a gang and was always in a knife fight or something. When he finally got killed, gunned down outside the showcase bar on 125th, nobody went to his funeral. We could tell the action was picking up all over. The airstrikes were picking up. The rumble of the big guns started as soon as it was light enough to see and sometimes lasted far into the night. Most of it was outgoing, but not all of it. Once in a while, a mortar shell would land near the base, and then we would all run out into the trench built in front of the tent. We reinforced that sucker with some 2x4s that Lieutenant Gearhart had flown all the way up from Saigon. Most of the patrols going out were Vietnamese, and Johnson said that he didn't think most of them were really patrolling.
They ain't out a kilometer before you hear popping, he said.
He was right. Half the time the ARVNs would go out, especially at night, they would be back within a half hour saying that they had been hit by a company of Charlies. Then we would go on alert and send out a few rounds and spend the rest of the night in the trenches. I won $30 in the football pool. I had Green Bay and a point total of 48, which was closer than anybody else. I sent the money to Mama. I got a rash or something on my feet. Pee-wee wanted me to put some of the salve he had bought from the old woman on them, but I said no. I remembered how his face had broken out. At the new camp, we had been working more and higher ground,
and I thought the small cracks between my toes would heal. They didn't. A medic from Tom Key came by with the pills and gave me some powder for my feet and told me to keep them as dry as possible.
Your feet get messed up and you're going to end up with a profile.
Yeah, thanks. Lobo damn near dragged Jamal into our hooch.
Go ahead, tell him what you heard, Lobo said to Jamal.
Sergeant Simpson and Captain Stewart got into a fight, Jamal said. Captain Stewart told Sergeant Simpson that if he didn't shut up and get out, he was going to bust him down to private.
Who the hell does he think he is?
Brunner asked.
What they fighting about? Johnson asked.
Brunner got up and walked away.
He found out that Captain Stewart is volunteering Alpha Company all over the place. He asked him what he's doing that for, and Captain Stewart said that if he didn't want to fight, he shouldn't have extended.
What Jamal said went down hard. We didn't mind doing our part because it had to be done, even though we always didn't have answers to why we were doing it. But nobody wanted to go out and risk their lives so that Stewart could make major. The mortars started coming in more regularly over the next 3 days, and the ARVN patrols started staying out shorter and shorter times. We didn't go out for almost a week, but when I saw Captain Stewart talking to Gearhart, I figured something was up. I was right. We were headed for another patrol. The patrol turned out to be a company-sized sweep. We were supposed to take off at 1000 hours. At 0930 hours, three Hueys escorted by two Spookies, huge C-47 gunships, came in. It was the rest of our outfit. Lobel wrote a long letter to his father, telling him that he was sorry about joining the army. He put it in his gear at the hooch before he went on the sweep.
You really sorry? I asked.
He shrugged, and I dropped it. I wondered how my father would take it if I got killed. I told myself that I didn't care. The more I thought of it as we waited to load up, the more I began to understand how Lobo felt. Having people care about you was probably the only thing that made any of it right. Having them not care made your whole life wrong. The company hit the landing zone at 11:17 hours. Some squads from 2nd Platoon went in first. They didn't get any fire, but they looked confused on the ground. We soon got the word that there were punji sticks in the tall grass we were jumping down into. They were sharpened sticks stuck into the ground or in pits. Usually they were covered with shit, either human shit or animal shit, so when they stuck you, you got infected. No one in our squad hit the punji sticks as we landed, and we started moving out toward the wood line. There was no resistance. We got into the wood line and formed a skirmish line. Monocle spotted a mine symbol. He called Gearhart over and showed it to him. There were three leaves rolled into the shape of a triangle at the base of a tree. We looked around for the mine but didn't see one. Then Johnson found it. It was one of our sea ration cans rigged to a limb that you would have to push out of your way if you were over 6 feet tall. Monocle blew the mine, and we went on.
Look for shells, burnt leaves, anything that says Charlie's been here, Captain Stewart said.
We found the damn mine, Pee-wee muttered to me. The Tooth Fairy didn't leave that sucker.
The wood led up a hill, and the grass was getting taller. I hated it. You couldn't see through the grass, and you were scared shit of stepping on a mine.
Keep your distance! Keep your distance!
Gearhart. We were going uphill. You had to lean forward and sometimes catch at brushes with your hands. You didn't want to touch anything that you didn't have to, or pull anything. I went through a brush and nearly had a heart attack when the thick branches hooked my M16 and jerked it out of my hand. I turned and saw Pee-wee. He disentangled my piece and handed it to me. He smiled. We got a quarter of the way up the hill when a guy in the next squad called out.
What is it? Stewart called to him.
Looks like a spider hole.
It was a corporal, tall, sleeves rolled up, tattooed arms. Stewart stopped the company and a couple of men approached the hole. A spider hole is a hole dug in the ground that's big enough for one man, sometimes two.
but sometimes they're disguised and there's a tunnel entrance in back of them. The corporal fired a few rounds into the hole and then looked in.
Empty, he said.
Look around for more, Stewart called out, and be alert. Just then, the whole damn mountainside opened up. The tall corporal spun around from the impact of the bullets and came flying forward.
Up the hill! Up the hill!
Gearhart was on his knees and pointing up. Simpson was firing, and I opened up. We started scrambling up the hill toward where the fire was coming from. I heard the rounds whining and buzzing around my head like angry bees. I was doubled up, firing, from a crouched position. I moved against a tree and aimed at where I thought they had to be.
This way! This way!
Gearhart was going up first. I found myself going up after him. Johnson and Lobel were on our left. Johnson got down and started spreading fire. Brew was feeding him. I kept firing, moving under Johnson's cover. We hit a ledge and I almost fell over a dead Kong. When we got to the ledge, we were less than 30 meters from the top of the hill. Gearhart had got a M79 from someplace and was shooting grenades to the top. Some guys threw some grenades over the top, and Johnson and another 60 raked it over pretty good. We made the last 30 meters in less than a minute, with everybody throwing grenades over the top. Stewart was on the phone. The choppers and the jets would be in the air already. We got to the top, and there were three more Kongs on the ground. One was only wounded. He was half sitting up, and I think he was trying to get his hands up. Captain Stewart opened up on him, and his head snapped back and his arms flailed for a moment, even after I knew he was dead. We got to the crest of the hill and started firing down the other side. We didn't see any Kongs, but they had to be there somewhere. The fact that we had found four bodies was a miracle.
Incoming!
I dove to the ground and bounced up to my knees as the blast hit. I tried to stand, but my legs went out from under me. What the hell was happening?
To the left! That way! That way!
I heard Gearhart calling out. I saw Johnson. He had a rag or something around the 60 and was shooting it from the hip. Another round hit, and I saw Johnson go to his knees.
Oh, Jesus! Oh, Jesus!
I looked around. It was Brew. There was blood gushing out from the top of his leg. I could see the bone.
Medic! Medic!
I tried to get over to Brew. My head was spinning. I thought I was too scared to move. I tried to force myself to move. Then I looked down and saw that my pants were ripped open. I saw the flesh already starting to swell. I was hit.
Oh, Mama. Oh, Mama, please don't let me die. Get the choppers in here!
I pushed myself over on my stomach and looked for my rifle. The next round lifted me, and I felt something hit my wrist and tear into the flesh. I felt as if somebody was putting a hot iron on my wrist, then dragging it through the flesh.
Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God, please. Back off the fucking hill. They got it zeroed.
I could get one eye open. I saw Gearhart backing down the hill. He was firing the grenade launcher and looking around. I felt somebody grab me by the collar. I couldn't turn around. My leg twisted under me and there was pain. But more than the pain in my leg, more than my wrist dangling in front of me, was the thought that I was going to die. I was going to die. Oh, God. Oh, God, please. Please.
Chapter 16. I was trembling. I didn't feel any pain, but I couldn't move. There was stuff going on all around me. I saw guys moving past me, blurs. I heard cursing. The sounds of automatic weapons seemed to be a rippling that swelled from somewhere. What was going on? How long was it going to last? What have we run into?
How you doing, man? How you doing?
Jamal was over me. He was opening my shirt.
I got hit, I said. I couldn't see him too clearly.
Yeah, I know.
He was looking at my chest.
He lifted me and looked at my back. Then he laid me back down and started looking at my groin. I just kept looking into his face. Guys were still moving around. I tried to lift my head, but I couldn't. I couldn't because I was too scared to move. Breathing was hard. I was panting. I wondered if I had been hit in the chest. I couldn't tell.
"Watch the ridgeline! Watch the ridgeline!"
Gearhart's voice. Everything began to fade except the sound of the Sixie. My eyes were closed and I opened them. Jamal moved my leg.
Ooh!
There was pain. It wasn't too bad, but why couldn't I move? Why couldn't I breathe? Now there were people over me. Things were getting clearer. I looked up and saw Pee-wee. His helmet was on the back of his head, his rifle under his arm. He looked down at me. I tried to say something to him, but nothing came out. Choppers overhead. They were laying down a line of fire. They came down, then back up again. Two other guys were near me. I closed my eyes, and one of them pushed them back open and looked at them. Then he let them close. I opened them again. They were talking to Jamal. One of them was wiping my arm. I tried to turn to see what he was doing, and the other one pushed me back down. More faces over me. I was being lifted. I was on a litter. My throat was dry.
"How you doing, soldier boy?"
A clean-looking dude with a southern accent. "Okay," I said.
"You gonna stay that way, too,"
he said. He patted me on the shoulder. I was on the chopper. The chopper was different now. The straps on the side were huge. The handles were further out from the wall. There was more noise, even, than before. Smells. Smells of dirt, of sweat, of funk. The smell of blood that I remembered from Jenkins. Bodies gathered around me. The chopper jolted up. There were guys kneeling near me, their backs toward me. I could see their backs.
"I still got a pulse. You ain't got no pulse, man." "I got a pulse." "No, maybe not."
There were boots and mud in my face as a guy shifted position. They were moving up and down next to me. I tried lifting my head to see what they were doing. My head swam. I looked between the guys working on somebody next to me. It was Brew. A guy was bent over him, giving him mouth to mouth. I turned away. There was something over me. It was shining. I thought I was going to pass out. Brew's arm came from between the two guys working on him. I took his hand. It was limp. I squeezed it, and I thought that he squeezed back.
"Keep pressure on the wound. It's not helping. It's too open. Just keep the pressure. Too many places. We gotta try to keep putting it in. Okay, okay, you keep looking. How's the other one?"
The boots scraped against my shoulder as they shifted position.
"Looks like shock, maybe a concussion. He breathing?"
A face over mine, lifting my neck. A mouth over mine, blowing air into me. I was a balloon. The air pushed into my chest. I gasped.
"He's breathing. Watch him. See if the legs are swelling."
As they started probing my legs, I turned to see Brew again. There were tubes. A medic had what looked like the thing you use to take baby bottles out of hot water. He kept moving it toward Brew's stomach. The breathing was terrible. Brew's breathing, sucking air. I looked at his face. He wasn't moving. His mouth was closed. Where was the breathing coming from? The helicopter's engines whined. The medic bent over Brew.
"I got nothing, man. I got nothing. Okay, that's it."
The medic turned to me quickly. He started wiping my face, the corners of my mouth.
"How you doing, big guy?"
I nodded.
"You play basketball?"
Beyond the medic's shoulder, I could see them covering Brew. The medic was checking the bag above me. I tried to move so I could see what they were doing with Brew. The medic saw me. He moved into my line of vision.
"You're gonna be okay," he said.
You just got a little concussion, a little steel, a little dirt, the whole thing.
I heard the zipper. I didn't have to see it. I heard the zipper. The medic took my hand. He squeezed it. Then he took the other one and squeezed that one. Then he started on my legs.
Perry! Perry!
The voice came to me from a long way away.
Come on, Perry. Wake up, man.
I opened my eyes. A tall, dark-skinned brother with shades.